On the line with us right now is Diane Ravitch. She is research professor of education in New York University, at New York University, and historian of education. Diane is a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Last year, she won the Daniel Patrick Moynihan Prize of the American Academy of Political and Social Sciences in 2011, for her careful use of social science research for the public good. From 91 to 93, she was assistant secretary of education and counselor to Secretary of Education Lamar Alexander in the administration of President George H.W. Bush. From 97 to 2004, she was a member of the National Assessment Governing Board, which oversees the National Assessment of Educational Process, the federal testing program. She was appointed by the Clinton administration Secretary of Education Richard Riley in 97, reappointed in 2001. She's the author of the 2010 book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. We have a direct link there to her publisher, Basic Books, where you can purchase the book directly from them. Her most recent writing includes the New York Review of Books article, Two Visions for Chicago's Schools. If you click on her name, it takes you right to her website, DianeRavitch.com, Diane, RAVITCH.com, where she has links to all of her books, all of her articles, and you should be reading Diane Ravitch on a regular basis because this is some of the best writing that's going on in the country right now on education. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
It's great to have you back on the show. It was so enjoyable back in February. I had to get you back on the show. You know, when I'm reading your profile, I start thinking about how you're Assistant Secretary of Education under President George H.W. Bush, how you were the member of the National Assessment Governing Board, which oversees the National Assessment of Educational Process, the federal testing program. So I got two questions right off the bat for you. How is the educational policy of George H.W. Bush, how did that evolve into the educational policy of George W. Bush? Because I didn't hear as much about charter schools back during the George H.W. Bush administration. And then I heard a ton about it during the George W. Bush administration.
Right.
So how did that evolution happen?
Well, there are two different evolutions. One is my evolution because I went from being an insider over on the right to being a very activist leader of the protest against what's happening today with the demonizing of teachers' unions and the push for privatization of public education across the country. The other story is the evolution of national policy. The George H.W. Bush administration really observed the principle of federalism. That is to say that while there were ideas that the administration supported, like choice and the charter schools had just been opened really for the first time in 1990. So that was a brand new idea. Nobody knew quite where it was going or what it would turn into. But the George H.W. Bush administration didn't think that the federal government had the right or the power to tell everybody in the country what to do. I know that Lamar Alexander believed that change should occur through persuasion and not by mandates. But what happened was the George W. Bush administration was that they introduced this law called No Child Left Behind, which is loaded with mandates and which says that schools that don't meet, that reach 100% proficiency on student tests by 2014 will be subject to severe penalty. They might be privatized, they might be turned over into charter management, they might be given to the state, they might be closed. Well, never in our history have we have a federal law that was determined to close schools across the country. It's an insane law. So it's one of the reasons that I became disgusted with the right and found myself a critic, not a supporter of these ideas, because teachers are being bashed. The anti-union movement has gotten more and more powerful, and we now see this kind of astonishing bipartisan consensus around charter schools. And charter schools have really become a way of privatizing public education, and it's happening. Well, let's say that the latest data is 88% of the charter schools in this country are non-union, and that is no accident.
I know this kind of sounds like a crazy question, and it might sound like a very Fox News-ish question, but do Americans have a legal right to a free education?
Yeah, they're not in the Constitution. The Constitution says nothing about education.
Okay.
But every state has, in its own state constitution, that the state has to provide a free public education, and that in some states, there's actually a clause saying that no money can go to religious schools. But that's now being interpreted very ingeniously in many states because there are several states that have passed voucher laws where money goes directly to religious institutions like Louisiana and Indiana and Wisconsin. But it's a state-level law or a constitutional requirement to provide a free public education.
So is what happened with the George W. Bush administration with this No Child Left Behind, as you were saying, very different from the George H.W. Administration. They didn't want to tell people have some sort of mandate. They believed in federalism. They didn't want to have a top down from the federal government telling what the states should do. Is that why No Child Left Behind was popular with many Democrats, because it was a big government, it was a Republican created big government solution that almost sounded like it would have come from the Democrats?
Well, yeah, that's very brilliant insight on your part, because Democrats embraced No Child Left Behind. I mean, people like Teddy Kennedy was a co-sponsor of the No Child Left Behind legislation, because they thought, well, you know, this means serious new money for the schools. It means that there'll be protection for poor kids. Well, what it really means is that all this new money is going into testing and test prep, and now it's going into technology. We're seeing a ballooning of class sizes across the country. We're seeing budget cutting across the country. No Child Left Behind is leaving lots and lots of kids behind, and they're all the same kids who were left behind. And I think the most insidious and odious part of No Child Left Behind is it all hinges on standardized testing. And it's in the nature of standardized tests that they're norm tests. That means that it's a bell curve, and half the kids are below and half the kids are above. And it's always the poor kids who are in the bottom half. So if you wanted to pick a technical strategy to leave kids behind, you would do exactly what No Child Left Behind requires, which is to make standardized testing the be-all and end-all and the actual point of schooling. So it's been, I think, a really horrible law. It's demoralized teachers. I mean, the evidence on that is overwhelming. There have been many surveys now of teachers. Two of them came out just this past spring showing massive demoralization, because teachers realize they're losing their professional autonomy. They can't teach as they'd like to. Many teachers are being given scripted curricula and told, this is what you do today and this is what you do tomorrow. And that's not professional.
As I said a couple of times so far, you were a member of the National Assessment Governing Board, which oversees the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the federal testing program. So you were somebody who was overseeing the federal testing program, but now you are somebody who is not enamored with the idea of using student test scores to determine the teacher's progress, the ability of the teacher. Can you explain why? Am I not making this connection right, or did you have an evolution of,
well,
of thought
there,
here,
there,
too?
There is a different way to look at this, which is the testing, the national testing, the federal testing program does not test individual students. It does not have any scores for individual students. It does not have scores for individual schools. So you can't, I think the national program, the federal program, is a very good program, because it's like a dipstick. And so you can say, well, you know, the state of California is making progress. This group is doing better. This group is not doing better. But what you can't do with tests is to take a test score and say, oh, based on this test score, I'm going to give out a bonus. I'm going to give you merit pay because your scores went up. Or I'm going to close your school because your scores didn't go up.
Right.
And that's what the Obama administration's been doing. So the NAEP continues to be, I think, a very valuable measure, because it can't be tied to any particular teacher or school. It's a sampling. It's given on a scientific sampling basis. There's no student who takes the whole NAEP test. Everyone takes a piece of it, and then it all gets mushed together, and you come out with a score for by states, where you can say this is how black students, Hispanic students, low-income students, high-income students. So NAEP continues to be a very useful measure, because there are no stakes attached to it. Where testing becomes poisonous is when you attach stakes to it, because then people forget why you're educating kids, and all they look at is the test score, and they get incentivized to do bad things that they wouldn't do if the testing weren't so important. For instance, there are schools now that have dropped the arts because they need more time for testing.
Right.
There are schools that have eliminated recess. They need more time for testing. There are districts like Washington, D.C. under Michelle Rhee, where there was massive cheating and there was a whitewash of an investigation. There are states that have lowered their passing mark to pretend, you know, and got score inflation to pretend that more kids were passing. So we're now into this kind of make-believe where testing rules everything, and it's really ridiculous.
You know, I might not might not have been a very good student, so I might not be getting this logic correct, but this is what doesn't make sense to me, Diane, and clear this up for me, because it just doesn't make sense. So a school does well on scores. Their scores are going up. Their scores, you know, they get really great scores, and so they are rewarded with resources from the government. A school gets really bad scores, so they do not get those resources. So aren't you just rewarding the people who are doing well and then making it so the bad schools, the places where scores are dropping, you're making it more difficult by pulling more resources away from them? You're making it even easier for the good schools to get better, and you're making it even harder for the bad schools to get worse. Am I getting something wrong?
Well, you're right, but it's actually worse than that, because now the federal government, Arne Duncan, has offered waivers for states that can't meet the No Child Left Behind deadline. The No Child Left Behind deadline says if you don't have 100% of your students proficient by the year 2014, your school will suffer grievous consequences like firing everybody and closing the school, which is absurd. So he said, well, I'll give you a waiver. You don't have to meet the deadline. But what you do have to do is to identify the lowest performing schools, call them priority schools. Identify the highest performing schools, call those award schools, reward schools. So it turns out that where do you think the reward schools are? It turns out that almost every one of them is in an affluent suburb populated largely by white families.
Right.
And where are the priority schools that are supposedly failing schools? They're in the inner city, and they're populated mostly by black and Hispanic kids, and they have massive problems. So the schools that are in the leafy suburbs will get a reward because they have white kids and upper-middle-income kids, and the schools in the inner city are now being targeted for closure and for punishment. And, you know, the bottom line is a lot of these schools that are called failing schools have great teachers in them. They're people who've dedicated their lives to educating kids who don't speak English, educating kids of which there are more in the inner city, educating kids who are impoverished and homeless, and they're going to be called bad teachers, and their school will be closed because they can't get those high scores. So this is the utter insanity of our current federal policy. But the worst part of the federal policy today, and this is Arne Duncan's innovation, inspired, by the way, by many people in California, like the New Schools Venture Fund and all these high-powered hedge fund people who like charter schools, is that they say that teachers should be judged by the test scores of their students. And what the research shows is that the test scores of the students go up the most if you're teaching affluent kids. They're easiest to teach. They don't go up very much if you're teaching kids who have disabilities. They don't go up very much if you have kids who are English language learners. And so teachers will be penalized based on who they're teaching if they're teaching the toughest kids or the most challenging kids. And if you everybody should be encouraged, I guess, by this law or these laws that are being passed now all over the country to go where the jobs are the least demanding in terms of the kids who are in the classroom. So it's what I see in federal policy right now is just an effort to push everybody to say, I want to get out of this. I want to go to a charter school. They don't have unions. They don't have to be subject to these same federal requirements. They're free of most of all these regulatory burdens. It's almost as though there is all the pieces fit together. The testing demands and the regulatory demands and the mandates are making the charter schools look better every day.
You started your article in the New York Review of Books on the Chicago teachers' strike by writing this. According to most news reports, the teachers in Chicago are striking because they are lazy and greedy, or they are striking because of a personality clash between Mayor Rahm Emanuel and Union President Karen Lewis, or because this is the last gasp of a dying union movement, or because Emanuel wants a longer school day and the teachers oppose it. None of this is true. And we heard the teachers are striking because they're lazy and greeting comment when it came to the collective bargaining battle that was going on within Wisconsin, as well as in Ohio and other places as well. The constant drumbeat of teachers being lazy and greedy. What do you blame this misunderstanding on? Is it the media, lack of understanding of the issues? Is it our bad education system? Is it the ability of anti-union forces to get out their message? Why, in your opinion, do news reports get this so wrong?
Well, I do think that there are a lot of reporters who are just listening to the voices of the privatizers, listening to those who say the unions are the cause of all of our problems. If we could get rid of unions, all the test scores would go up and we would be the best in the world. None of this is true. If you look at it, you know, and I go back to the federal testing measure, on the federal test, the highest performing states in the country are the ones that are completely unionized. The lowest performing are the ones that are right-to-work states or non-union states or weak union states. So if you just look at evidence, every state should have a teachers union to fight for better resources, better compensation for the teachers. And there's also in this country right now an absolutely astonishing anti-teacher sentiment, and I don't think it's accidental. I think it's been fed by the media. You could hear it not just on Fox News, but on CNN, and so many of the major newspapers wrote editorials attacking the teachers union and not listening to what they were saying. The union was striking because there are terrible teaching conditions in Chicago, overcrowded classes. There are kindergartens with 40 children in a classroom with no one to help the teacher. There are classes across the city that where kids are in the classroom in summer school and there's no air conditioning and it's sweltering. There are schools there that have no library and no librarian. There are schools that have no art teachers. So the teachers were really fed up with, they've been the petri dish for reform, you know, Arne Duncan style, Paul Vallis style, Rahm Emanuel style reform now for almost 20 years. For almost 20 years, they've had mayor control where the school board does whatever the mayor wants because he appoints the board. And the mayor and whoever he put in charge is the superintendent, and Arne Duncan was the superintendent there for 8 years. They have reformed those schools again and again and again. They've opened over 100 of these private charter schools, privately managed charter schools, that are non-union. All during the strike, the charter schools were open. And there were, you know, the hedge fund manager, equity-type people were running multi-million-dollar ads saying, since your kid did charter school, they'd be in school now. Their teachers can't strike.
Right.
So all of this is of a piece. It's an effort to demonize teachers, demonize their union, say that teachers should be willing to work for much less. Well, why should they work for less? I mean, this is a hard job. And when they said, with people would say with shock, oh, my gosh, teachers in Chicago have an average salary of $75,000. Like, how astonishing that is. So many of the people saying this were making $300,000, $400,000, $500,000. Why should they begrudge a professional who has a college degree and a master's degree and has a very tough job? Why should they begrudge them a solid middle-class income? So this is, I think, a narrative that we're hearing. It's part of the privatization narrative. It's part of an effort to destroy teacher unionism. And, you know, as we've seen just in the last year, Tennessee abolished collective bargaining. Ohio tried to abolish collective bargaining. Wisconsin did eliminate public sector collective bargaining, for at least for teachers and the female professions, but did not eliminate it for cops and firemen. But there is, you know, the right in this country is back now, in my view, to being in the 1920s. This is pre-New Deal thinking.
Yeah, and in Wisconsin now, a judge has ruled that some of that collective bargaining some of the collective bargaining law is not constitutional, and so they're...
Yeah, but that was a county judge.
Right,
you know they're
exactly.
going to appeal it.
Exactly.
And the next level will be people who are appointed by Scott Walker.
Exactly.
But hopefully they can keep this going legally, because it's outrageous. You know, the people who work should have a right to be represented in negotiations over what their working conditions are.
We're speaking with Diane Ravitch. She is research professor of education at New York University, and she was assistant secretary of education and counselor to Secretary of Education Lamar Alexander in the administration of President George H.W. Bush. So a contract has not been signed, but the Chicago Teachers Union has gone back to school immediately. There were ads on local TV news here in Chicago. I don't know if you've seen them or not, with Rahm Emanuel claiming victory on the strike. The ads cost $1 million, and as the Chicago Tribune reported yesterday, in a political-style TV and radio ad blitz launched Wednesday, Emanuel says, "Change is never easy," but declares the outcome of the strike the right deal for our kids. The ads are being paid for by a nonprofit arm of a political action committee started by Wall Street hedge fund managers who believe the creation of privately run charter schools is the best avenue to reform. In fact, there are Chicago, that's the end of that quote, but it's just my point of view. There are Chicago Public School Board members appointed by Mayor Emanuel. They're also linked to the privately run but publicly funded charter schools. Those who are for charter schools will say they support these schools because they do a better job of educating kids. Those against charter schools say charter schools are just there to make a buck off your kid. Do you think that the people who are supporting charter schools, this move away from a free public education to a pay an education that you have to pay for? And I know that Mitt Romney and Barack Obama have talked about giving people vouchers to help them pay for that school. It doesn't pay for all of their school, and they're going to have to still be paying taxes, and it's going to be more and more cost out of pocket. Do you believe that the people who believe in charter schools, are they true believers? They really think that this is the way to go, or are they simply profiteers?
Well, they're mixed motives. Okay. There are people who think that charter schools are wonderful because particularly, and I've met many people who say, but, you know, we're saving children. Even if we can only save a few, we can save some. And I say to them, but, you know, the charter schools don't get any different results from the public schools unless they skim, which many of the charter schools do. There are many high-scoring charter schools where they kick kids out. If they don't get the high scores, they kick them out. Well, you can get high scores if you kick out the low-scoring kids. You can also get high scores if you keep out the English language learners, and if you kick out the kids with severe disabilities or never admit them. You know, you just keep pushing kids out. Many of the charter schools with high scores have a high attrition rate. There are some that are really terrific schools, but they're very few. Most of the charter schools are no better than the regular public schools, and on average, and study after study has shown this, the charters don't get higher scores. Of course, I don't think the scores are what it's all about. I think there is something about maintaining a democratic institution called public education that's free and open to all, where the school doesn't have the right to pick and choose or the right to kick kids out because their scores are too low. What we're seeing with the charter movement is that there is a lot of money behind it. I mean, you have these foundations like the Gates Foundation, the Broad Foundation, the Walton Foundation, the Dell Foundation, and you could go on and on, the John and Laura Arnold Foundation. There are a long list of the foundations that are supporting charters, and they're supporting, then you've got the Wall Street hedge fund managers, and they have a group called, very deceptively named, Democrats for Education Reform. And the Democrats for Education Reform support only charters. They do not support public schools at all, only charters. They support charters that invade public schools and take their space away. And then their charters don't take the same kids. And they boast about their scores and say, we should have the whole building, not just half of it. In New York City, we have maybe close to 100 charter schools now that have taken public school space. So they pay no rent. They get all their expenses paid. And yet they have a private board with hedge fund managers on it who are billionaires. Well, why should they get free public space? But what we're seeing in New York and in New Orleans, and New Orleans is one of the big hype stories of our time. New Orleans is now a district where 80% of the kids are in charter schools, and we constantly hear this refrain of the miracle of New Orleans. The reality is that in the state of Louisiana, there are 70 school districts, and New Orleans is the 69th out of 70. Every little change in test scores, they'll say, look, we're a miracle. Well, there is no miracle there. Almost 80% of the charters in that city got a D or an F from the state the last time they handed out grades. But now that Bobby Jindal has taken over the State Board of Education, with money from the hedge fund managers, by the way, and a $100,000 contribution from Mayor Bloomberg in New York City, they took control of the state school board. They now control the state education department. I don't know what kind of data we'll be getting in the future about what's happening in New Orleans, but there is no miracle in New Orleans. This is all about privatizing, handing over public schools to private ownership, private management, and then getting rid of unions, which they did in New Orleans and which they have done in many states now, and cutting the cost of teaching by replacing teachers with computers. That's a big thing for Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush is now the big – Jeb Bush and Joel Klein are the big technology salesmen. And their pitch is, look how much money you can save if you replace teachers with computers.
Wow. You know how much money we could save by replacing Chicago Public School Board members with computers, Diane? It would be amazing. one of the things that I was thinking about while you were answering the question was, why are the Democrats, why have they become so anti-union. We've been told by Fox News that the unions are why the Democrats exist, that they're propped up by this corrupt money from mafiosos running unions, and therefore, you know, it wouldn't make sense that they would be going against unions. What explains to you why the Democrats are going after their base, the unions, where they get tons of money?
Well, it's obviously very complicated. I don't understand, for example, why the Democratic National Convention was held in a right-to-work state.
Right.
I mean, this is the first time in my memory that a Democratic National Convention was held in a state like North Carolina that doesn't have unions. Can you explain that?
I think one word, money. The other thing that you mentioned earlier about New Orleans and them failing, and this is the important part of your article and the important part of the whole Chicago teacher strike, is who's running New Orleans schools. I know that as of last year was Paul Vallis. I don't know if he's still down there.
Paul Vallis went from New Orleans to he's now in Bridgeport, Connecticut,
okay,
where he is being paid $229,000, and he's also running a private consulting business to teach people how to save their schools and reform their districts. The problem with Paul Vallis is he ran the schools in Chicago and claimed victory there, having reformed them.
Right.
He then went to Philadelphia, where he claimed victory for having reformed them. Philadelphia is now about to be subject to massive privatization because the same privateers and the Boston Consulting Group, which is the group of management consultants that Bain Consulting came from, so it ties back to Romney. Boston Consulting Group is advising school systems around the country that the way to save themselves is to hand schools over to private management. You know, I have to add, because this is really important for the discussion,
because
you're talking in Chicago,
right?
And we all hear about failure, failure, failure. The test scores of American students on the NAEP, this is the federal testing program, are at their highest point in history. We are so accustomed now to hearing from Bill Gates and from Arne Duncan and from Michelle Rhee and from Joel Klein and from Condoleezza Rice about how our schools are terrible, terrible, and the scores are bad, we're falling behind the world. This is all baloney, nonsense. Our kids today in American public schools have the highest test scores in history. And I'm looking at the NAEP, which has been testing kids for 40 years. There have never been higher scores for white kids, black kids, Hispanic kids, or Asian kids. But you never hear that from them. The graduation rates are today the highest they have ever been in history. The graduation rates of the group from 18 to 24 are at 90%. But you won't hear that from any of these figures. All they talk about is failure. The failure narrative, I mean, we're talking about a kind of a shock doctrine approach to go around and keep saying again and again and again that our schools are failing. They are not failing. Our society is failing because we have nearly 25% of our kids living in poverty. And when kids are poor, they don't have the same health care. They don't have the same access to, you know, everything that money buys. That makes a difference in school. And the teachers are dealing with the effects of poverty. And then we blame the teachers. So I think when you asked earlier, what's the reason for the anti-teacher rhetoric that we hear? It's because teachers are an easy scapegoat. We can blame them instead of looking at our society and saying, why do we have the highest child poverty rate of any advanced nation in the world?
And I want to get to that, the aspect of poverty, because last time we had you on the show, you mentioned this. Yesterday, the New York Times reported that when thousands of poor families were given federal housing subsidies in the early 1990s to move out of impoverished neighborhoods, social scientists expected the experience of living in more prosperous communities would pay off in better jobs, higher incomes, and more education. That did not happen. But more than 10 years later, the families' lives have improved in another way. They reported being much happier than a comparison group of poor families who were not offered subsidies to move, a finding that was published on Thursday in the journal Science. Of course, those transplanted poor didn't get better jobs, better pay, or a better education because, as the article points out, the kids had to stay in their old impoverished schools. But the study was able to quantify the happiness at $13,000 a year. And then they quote William Julius Wilson, a sociology professor at Harvard and author of the 1987 book, The Truly Disadvantaged, which, as the Times says, pioneered theory about concentrated poverty. Wilson says, mental health and subjective well-being are very important. If you are not feeling well, it's going to affect everything, your employment, relations with your family, everything. What this study tells me is you can overcome some of the negative effects of poverty by ending segregation, but without giving everyone free and equal access to education, then education's jobs won't improve. In your opinion, is education the key to ending poverty, or is ending poverty the key to a better education?
What I've consistently argued is that we have to think of both at the same time. Our current crop of reform, education reformers, who I think call corporate reformers, they say we don't have to worry about poverty, we just have to fix the schools and that'll take care of poverty. But it doesn't. It doesn't, because the kids have so many disadvantages. They will be consistently in the bottom half. There will be a few who will use education to escape, but it's a trickle-up theory. It's not one that will end poverty. The way to end poverty is to address the causes of poverty. People are poor because they don't have enough income. They're working hard, but I think in this society today, we're seeing a dramatic expansion of income inequality. We're seeing a hollowing out of the middle class. And I think increasingly people, whether they're black or white, if they're at the bottom, they feel utterly hopeless. They feel that there is no way for them, no matter how many years of education they get, to ever get out of their student debt, to ever be able to actually have a secure middle-class life. That's the American dream, the idea that you can move up, that you can have a good middle-class life. And I think that that's what's at risk right now, and the schools are not the cause of that. The schools do not control the economy. The schools don't create jobs. So there's a much more aggressive approach that's required of our national leadership. And it should not be blaming schools. It should not be closing schools. It should be addressing poverty and racial segregation. There's no question in my mind that when you look at where these schools are that are labeled failing schools, the overwhelming majority of them are in regions and neighborhoods where there's a toxic combination of segregation and poverty. And a sense of hopelessness.
Diane, one last question for you. We've been speaking with Diane Ravitch. She is research professor of education at New York University and historian of education. You can find out more about Diane by going to her website, Diane Ravitch, RAVITCH.com, or just going to our website and clicking on Diane's name. She writes regularly for the New York Review of Books, and you should read all of her past art. It really is enlightening work that she does on education. It's some of the best that's out there right now. But Diane, I have one last question for you, and as always, as we do for each and every one of our guests, it's the question from hell, the question we hate to ask, you might hate to answer, our audience is going to hate the response. You were saying that the American dream is improving yourself, getting better from generation to generation, your kids being better off than you. But I thought the American dream was paying less in taxes. Is that what's happened? Is that what we're paying for right now when we look at whatever, as you were saying, that test scores are better than ever. But when we are looking at any of the problems that we are having in our education system, is it simply because this is what you get for paying less taxes?
Let me suggest, because you didn't mention it, I have a blog that I write every day. I post about 10 or 20 things a day.
That's right.
It's at DianeRavitch.net. And the last thing I posted is called A Dialogue About Raising Taxes. And one of my readers, who's a teacher, said she was absolutely opposed to taxing the rich because that was just redistributing the wealth, you know, heaven forbid. And, you know, my view is that we're seeing, first of all, the rich today have probably the lowest tax rates they've ever had in history. During the Eisenhower administration, people who were super rich paid way more than they're paying today, and the country's prospered. So I don't mind saying that you get what you pay for. And people think that if they can just cut the wages of teachers, they're going to get better teaching, and that's absurd. What I'm hearing from people who prepare teachers is the number of young people wanting to become teachers is declining. What I see in the national data is that veteran teachers are retiring at an unprecedented rate. We're making the teaching profession unprofessional, and we're making it unattractive to people who might have a lifelong dream of becoming a teacher. So we're not going to improve if you think that the point of education reform is to improve education, we're not doing that. Today, the point of education reform is to cut taxes, cut the budget, blame teachers, and privatize public education. So I think we're in a very bad place, and it concerns me that it's a bipartisan consensus around bad ideas of privatization and testing. And I expend all the energies I have to try to get the American public to wake up and realize that something very precious to them, the right to free public schooling, where their kids don't have to enter a lottery to get in, that right is in jeopardy.
And one other thing I wanted to mention about not only DianeRavitch.net, but I follow you on Twitter, and it is one of my favorite Twitter feeds that I get is the work that you do and the links that you post, not just to your own work, but other great writing on education. So that's another thing that people should be doing. They should be following you on Twitter as well. Diane, it's always a pleasure. It's always an honor having you on the show this morning. Enjoy the rest of your weekend, and you can bet that I'll be bugging you in emails in the future to get you back on the show.
Well, thank you, and you should know that Karen Lewis is a personal hero of mine. I think she's just an amazing, and, you know, I keep thinking of this line from back in the old Vietnam days when they would say, 1, 2, 3 Vietnams. We need more Karen Lewis's and more CTU.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Diane. Enjoy your weekend,
bye-bye.
And I'll talk to you soon. This is Hal every Saturday morning right here on WNUR 89.3 FM.